Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Where are my soccer fans this morning? You're in for a treat. My guest this hour is one of the most amazing athletes to ever play the game of soccer. Two-time Olympic gold medalist Brianna Scurry is joining me in the studio. She's a Minnesota native who graduated from Anoka High School and went on to play professional soccer and become a World Cup champion in 1999. Brianna is widely recognized as one of the greatest goalkeepers in the history of women's soccer. She has broken lots of barriers as a black woman and as an openly gay athlete. And now she's written a book that tells us all about it. Brianna shares personal stories about growing up in Minnesota and reclaiming her life after a devastating head injury that eventually ended her soccer career. Earlier this month, she released her memoir. The title is My Greatest Save, The Brave Barrier-Breaking Journey of a World Champion Goalkeeper. Brianna Scurry is here with me in the studio this morning, smiling at me. It's so great to meet you.
Thank you. It's so great to be here and to meet you as well.
Yeah, so you live now in the Washington, D.C. metro area. Mm-hmm. What is it like to come home to Minnesota when you've lived away for so many years?
It's been a wonderful time coming back here, although I will say it's a bittersweet for me a little bit because my mom and dad are no longer with us, and I just have been back here so many times to visit with them over the years, and this last 5 years has been a little bit bittersweet for me, but I'm excited to be here to promote my book and to see a lot of great teammates that I've had over the years and coaches as well, and to meet with people and talk to my book.
So there, a lot of people from your childhood and mm-hmm. high school, you still live here. You get to see them when you come.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. I had an event last evening, and there were five of my Anoka Tornado teammates in attendance. And so it was just a great reunion to see them. And a coach was there as well. So it's been fantastic.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
A few weeks ago, you tweeted, I follow you on Twitter, you tweeted this: many know of my soccer career, but few know of the brain injury that caused my deep depression or my long journey to recovery. So why did you want to tell the story about some very painful parts of your life in this book?
In 2019, I sat down with my publicist and my business manager, and we decided it might be time to write a book. We thought it was the right time at that point because it had been 20 years since I had been, you know, playing and doing all these different things, and we knew I had a book in me. But I wanted to be authentic to my entire journey and not just the good stuff. I wanted to make sure I gave voice and truth to some of the unpleasant things that I've experienced in my life. And once I realized I was ready and had enough distance from those things and in a great place in my life, we decided to jump into writing a book. And 2 years later, here we are.
When you came in this morning, I told you I see this book as a gift because too many of us, we don't talk about the sad things or the hard things. And so much can be learned from that, particularly when you have some distance and you get on the other side of it.
Absolutely. I feel so grateful and blessed to be on the other side of it. And I really truly believe that my story can really help everyone who reads it, whether they're in a great space in their lives or, like all of us, coming through this pandemic the last several years and still struggling in it. A lot of people need a little bit of encouragement and need some resilience. And I think my book is a great way to see someone's journey and, you know, to root for me getting through those tough times and to see that I actually did make it and they can too.
I want to talk about your birthday. You celebrated your 50th birthday last fall. And this speaks to me because, you know, for me, turning 50, it prompted a career change. Mm. What did turning 50 last fall mean for you?
Ooh,
did you do the leg kick? I'm 50.
Woo!
Did you do that?
I definitely did. 50 for me was a huge birthday. I looked back on all the great things in my life, everything I've done, and my legacy, and I wanted to make my next 30 years plus of my life mean something as much as my previous 50 had meant. And so becoming 50 was huge for me, very, very powerful. And it makes you reflect. Mm-hmm. I was very, very pensive about looking at my life and where I'm at and what I want to do going forward. And this book is definitely part of that.
So let's talk about the title of the memoir, My Greatest Save, The Brave Barrier-Breaking Journey of a World Champion Goalkeeper. Choosing that title, Greatest Save, is obviously a metaphor. Yes. How did that come about?
So I obviously am most well known for this penalty kick save in the 99 World Cup in the shootout. Most people would think that that was my greatest save, but I have felt and known for a long time that I have had to make many different saves on and off the pitch. And so the title is more of a reflection on the most difficult time in my life. You know, when I was suicidal, I was really struggling. I was dealing with a lot of different feelings, an insurance company with my concussion situation. And I just essentially was really in the depths of despair, and depression was basically pulling me into this deep, dark hole. And when I was thinking about how I might in my life, that was a real alarming and wake up call for me. And I thought to myself, well, what would that mean? And instantly, the vision of my mother, who was dealing with Alzheimer's at the time, but still knew me, and when I would go and visit her, somebody would have to knock on her door and inform her that her baby was gone. And that visual that I had at that moment is what made me pull back off the ledge and come back into life and gave me stability. And so after that, I was thrown a lifeline, and a lot of people were helping me and pulling for me. And I was able to come out of that after getting a procedure done and then a year of therapy. So my greatest save on the pitch is the one that most people know, but I wanted to share my greatest save was me.
How critical was it for you to have made good choices along the way of your support system and your friends? Because mm-hmm. I'm thinking it was some solid relationships mm-hmm. that also helped save you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had amazing friends at that time who were always encouraging and who knew a lot about my situation. And when I asked for money for loans, because the insurance company, I was on disability at the time, really struggling, and the insurance company sometimes wouldn't pay when they were supposed to. And so I would literally go into essentially a panic state, not knowing when the money was coming. And my friends, Naomi and Carrie, were always so helpful and supportive in listening to me and being there. And their hearts were broken by how bad my situation was, but they really didn't know the true depths of where I was. But I didn't want to burden them. I didn't want to be a burden. Oh, and I was also ashamed of where I was, even though it wasn't my fault.
And you didn't have health insurance, right? For parts of this, that was part of the problem too.
Absolutely. That was the problem. So initially my injury was, you know, athlete injured until you got medical care. But when I retired from the game because of the injury mm-hmm. and also the league folded, my classification changed into a workers' comp situation. And the MO with workers' comp often is deny, deny, deny. And so they didn't believe me that a literal head injury that occurred during a game was the source of my pain. And so I had to fight them. And that's part of the reason why it took 3 years to get to the right assistance and the right help.
Tell us about the writing process. And I know from the cover it says that the book was co-written by New York Times bestselling author Wayne Coffey.
Yes.
So how did you and Wayne and maybe others, how did you approach writing about your life? Because, you know, we're talking mm-hmm. about, again, extreme highs and yes. extreme lows. How do you even begin this process?
Well, that's a fantastic question. We had some challenges just to begin it, because we started it in March 2020. Which is exactly when the pandemic
started.
Began.
Yeah.
Yes. And Wayne and I had planned on meeting in person and talking and interviewing mm-hmm. frequently about the book. And he was going to also go and, you know, see different places
travel.
I would talk about and, mm-hmm. and do the research, but he couldn't do any of that for the first 6 months to a year because of the pandemic, you know, all the lockdowns and restrictions. And so he was doing a lot of this information and getting this information from phone calls and Zoom calls and whatnot. And it was a very different process for him. Mm-hmm. But he and I, we spoke all the time, all the time. And just getting to the feeling space is what was so vitally important to both of us in the process. So we would talk about a situation, and then he would have questions for me and follow up to fill in the gaps. And every time we would talk, it was so powerful for me to tell him about how I felt about certain things, because so much in my book I've never talked about before. And it was really,
really
important. Yes, it was really important to get that right so the reader could go through the book and literally feel like they were getting to know me, like they were going on the journey with me.
It's definitely written that way. I'm with you through all of this. but isn't it hard reliving some of the tough moments?
It was incredibly difficult. Yes. So in my mind, I consider my life, a building, and the events in my life are different rooms in that building. And some of those rooms are locked and barricaded and the lights are out, because those are really difficult times that I didn't necessarily ever want to revisit again. But through this process of this book, I had to go back into those rooms in order to get back into the state of mind that I was in at the time that these things occurred. So, for example, when my father passed away on Father's Day, 2 months before the Olympic final, and having to be in the hospital room with him, fortunately.
What year was that, in 96 or 2004?
2004.
In 2004.
In June 2004, he passed away, and I just was lucky to be in the area traveling with my team and getting that phone call from the hospital after seeing him earlier that evening. There's never a good reason for a hospital to call, you know, late at night. You know it's something's wrong. And they said he had been coding to hurry up and get there. And so going there with my mom on one side of him and me on the other, holding his hand and seeing him there, and her telling him, it's okay. It's okay, we're here. You can let go now. Actually going back to that space to write about that is difficult, as you can probably tell, looking at me now. But it was important to do that because I wanted my book to be true and authentic to the situations in my life that I dealt with, so that the reader could see that you can come through really difficult times. And even though my dad was such an important part and so supportive in my life for so long, I'm grateful that I was there with him when he passed. And so I talk about that in great detail in the book, and then coming out of that and how I dealt with grief and the excitement of being at the Olympics and the grief about losing one of the main people who supported me getting there at the same time.
In 2004, that was the Olympics, it was in Greece.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you won your second gold medal there.
Absolutely, yes.
So let's go back and talk more about your childhood here in Minnesota. I know that you grew up in Dayton, Minnesota.
Yes, I did.
Shout out to Dayton this morning. And you went to Anoka High School in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. You're in the Anoka High School Hall of Fame.
Yes.
I saw that. I was like, oh, right there with the Olympic gold medals, Anoka High School Hall of Fame. What do you remember about high school? And particularly, I mean, I think now we talk a lot on this show about racial disparities.
Yes,
Brianna, and so what was Anoka High School like in the late 1980s when you're an athlete on a team?
I had a fantastic time at high school. Actually, in ninth grade, we petitioned the court to be able to play on the varsity soccer team, because Anoka High School is 10, 11, 12, and I was in ninth grade, and they didn't allow anyone to come up to play a team sport from the junior high school, so we had to petition. So I had to fight to get in there early, but had a fantastic high school career and experience. Played four sports in high school.
What were the others?
Soccer in the fall, basketball in the winter, traded softball, and track in the spring. And just really enjoyed it and was very focused on my athletics and my academics, and wanted to make sure that I was able to get a scholarship to college, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to go, because my family, although incredibly supportive and loving, didn't have a whole lot of money. And so I needed to be able to get a scholarship. So I had four sport athlete getting all these amazing offers for essentially soccer and basketball for the most part, and making a decision to go 1,500 miles away to college. But I would say high school was one of my most amazing times, because my mom and dad were supportive, and I was just really focused on who I was becoming and where I was going.
So Minnesota now much more diverse in 2020 than mm-hmm. when you were in high school in the late 80s.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that in terms of, you know, African-American students and white students and students of other races? Was everyone getting along well, or were there conversations about race at that time?
There wasn't really a whole lot of conversation at that time. And Anoka, I think, had 3,000 students going there. And I don't remember a whole lot of other students mm-hmm. that looked like me mm-hmm. in that rural area. But it didn't bother me, because I was just pursuing what I was passionate about. Everybody that I knew in my circles were really kind and nice to me. I was at that point just, you know, realizing who I was and who I was becoming, and just doing the best I could to make the great foundation that my parents had raised me on, and using that to springboard myself to college. And I was really supported by my teachers and faculty at Anoka.
So you're playing four sports. At what point does soccer become like, this is my sport, this is what I was meant to do? How did you get into playing soccer?
So I first started playing at 12 years old. A flyer came around in my classroom and it said, you know, soccer signups. So I took the flyer home to my mom and dad and said, can I play soccer? I had 2 years before that been playing tackle football, full pads, helmet, neck brace, the whole thing, and playing in the lightweight division, and I loved it. But my mom said, with boys. I was one of two girls that was in that league for those 2 years. And my mom and dad said I could play as long as I was playing in the lightweight division, which was 95 pounds and under. Mm-hmm. And then when I gained a little bit too much weight over the 95 pounds, mom said, okay, you're not playing with the heavyweights because they will essentially crush you. And with some, you know, some battle, some, you know,
resistance.
Hesitation, yes. Then soccer came right after that. And so I guess in retrospect, it was a great decision by my mom to have me do something else. And so that's where it started.
And then when was it decided upon, Brianna, goalkeeper? Like, mm-hmm. how did that come to be? Did a coach identify that, or was that you mm-hmm. pushing for that?
So that first year I played, I was the only girl on the boys team in Champlin and Dayton area. Mm-hmm. And the coach, in his infinite wisdom, thought it was the safest place for me to play in the goal as the only girl on the team, which is hilarious because it's actually the most dangerous place to put me. Bless his heart. He obviously didn't know, but he figured, oh, I'm over here by myself most of the game, I'm probably safer.
Less interaction.
Yes, exactly.
Of minutes, I guess.
Right. Potential collisions,
right,
and whatnot,
right.
And action, essentially. And so I loved it because I was excited about playing in a team sport again. I really enjoyed it. And then after that, I decided to go into the field the next 2 years playing on a girls' team. Mm-hmm. More girls were playing at that point, which is great. And then eventually, right around 15 or 16 years, I went back to the goal on a permanent basis and really just grew into that position, loved it, loved the possibility of stopping the other team from winning mm-hmm. if I could stop them from scoring. And I really leaned into that whole idea of being able to do that. And then as I grew up through the game, learning different skill sets, it just emerged. I was All-American in high school in soccer as a goalkeeper, and All-State in basketball. So clearly, wow. opportunity was most likely in soccer.
What's it like for you to look back? I've been looking back at photos and video of you, the facial expressions, and just like, you know, your body movements. When you look at those pictures, you're like, wow, I was into it. And I was, you know, what's it like to look at those pictures when you were really young and playing?
It's so interesting because I've been so focused, obviously, in my national team career for so long. Mm-hmm. And so to look back on those pictures and see, you know, little Bri in the goal, you know, with my little shirt on and my shorts and making these saves. And mm-hmm. I just recently saw the tape about the high school state final when I saved a penalty kick and then shot one and made it.
Wow.
Seeing that video was great. It was great. I was like, yep, I am the same person I was back then. It just grew up a little bit more.
Right. Yeah. You write in the book, you share in the book about how when you were playing early on and maybe, you know, later as a young adult, how white soccer mm-hmm. was.
Yes.
And how do you think that shaped your experience, both as a player and just as a person?
Yeah.
You know, being the only or one of just a few right. People of color playing the game.
Yes, I never actually had an issue with it. And my teammates were always so amazing. But I have learned through my book research that some of the other teams had issue with me. For example, one of my coaches, Pete Swenson, at the time when we were getting ready to play a club game, he overheard, he was standing at midfield during the warm-ups, and he overheard some of the other girls on the other team talking about, oh, that black goalkeeper over there, you know, this and that, and saying, you know, whispering, but he was standing right there. I don't think they mm-hmm. saw how close he was to them and that he overheard it. Then he came to me and he said, I just heard some girls talking about the black goalkeeper. Why don't you show them what the black goalkeeper could do? And I was like, okay, coach, let's go.
Let's go.
And we crushed them. It was awesome.
So you think that was more just that you were intimidating because they knew you were a great athlete? Yeah. Or was it really about, oh, she's different than us?
I think in retrospect, it was probably they were curious and saying that I was different than them, that they had never seen a black goalie before. And I just wanted to be able to, you know, express myself and live my passion and play the game too. But obviously, some people, you know, in retrospect, I realized might have had an issue with the fact that I was different than them. And the truth is, as we know now, inclusion is a better way to go. It's amazing. And my experience as the only, essentially, on every single team, the only black girl on every team I ever played. I recently, when I was here in 2015, after my mom passed away, she kept pictures of all my teams from all the years when I was a youth player for every single one of them. And it must have been the pile was probably 30 pictures or so. And every single picture, I was the only black girl on every single team.
And I hear that, and I just think that carries with it a lot of weight, mm-hmm. a lot of pressure. So mm-hmm. I'm the only, I have to be extra perfect. Right? Mm-hmm. Not just perfect. I can't mess up. I mean, right. Did you feel like pressure, like I'm representing or not? You're focused on the game.
Yes, it's interesting. I was focused on the game. At the time, I wasn't thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I was just doing what I love to do, which was be active and be passionate about sports and play mm-hmm. them. And oftentimes I was the best athlete and the best player on whatever the team was. And my teams were incredibly successful in every mm-hmm. sport I played in. And so I think the girls on the team just saw me as a teammate, as a friend, as one of them. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I got, you know, I don't see you as black, which at the time was interesting thing to say. And now I realize that the color blindness, essentially, is what they were talking about, is a very nuanced version of, you know, kind of diminishing.
It's problematic.
Yes.
Because the flip would be like, oh, if I saw you as black, then something
right.
might be different.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly right.
And so right now, so many, you know, parents right now have girls who are playing soccer. Mm-hmm. You know, do you see soccer today becoming or has it become a much more inclusive space for girls and young women who want to play? Have
Absolutely.
We made some gains?
Absolutely. We have made fantastic gains. And I'm just glad that so many young girls of color are able to participate now as opposed to back when I was playing.
I'm talking with soccer legend and Minnesota native Brianna Scurry about her new memoir called My Greatest Save. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. But first, let's get an update on today's news headlines. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Now back to the conversation with soccer legend Brianna Scurry. She has a new memoir out titled My Greatest Save, The Brave Barrier-Breaking Journey of a World Champion Goalkeeper. Lots of questions for you about some of the stories that are in the book. I don't want to give it all away, but there is one story where you share about a conversation you had with your college coach. You went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And after your sophomore year, he apparently told you he thought that you had potential to make the United States women's national team. And I loved your response. Can you tell us a little bit about that conversation?
Yeah, so Coach invited me into the office to talk to me, and he said, Bri, I think you have the potential to be on the U.S. women's national team. I said, great, Coach, but I didn't know we had one. Yes,
I know that was an option.
I did not know that was an option.
As a college student, you didn't.
Yes, right. That's correct.
Why is that? Just because you were in the moment or it was still new?
You know, I think it was a couple of things, maybe a little bit of naivete on my part, but also the World Cup was in 1991 in China. And essentially, they won the whole tournament, but no one here really knew about it. You had to be literally on that team, a family member or something, because it wasn't highly publicized in this country at all. The women came back from China with the World Cup trophy, and literally three people were at the airport to meet them when they returned.
Wow.
And it was essentially not even deemed an official credentialized World Cup FIFA event if FIFA did not put their name on it, because they didn't acknowledge it as an official World Cup event. Even though it was. So I didn't know anything about the national team. And then I said to Coach, I said, okay, you think I'm good enough to play on that team? I will take your confidence in me and make it my own. And I will work even harder to prove you right that I can do it. If you see in me enough and a great enough skill set and potential that I could make that national team, I'm all in.
Right. And it happened.
It did.
It turns out. And so as you look at your career with the United States women's national team, is there a moment? I'm sure there are many moments. Mm-hmm. What are some of the moments that really stand out to you sort of in the beginning, in the early stages?
Sure. So we played a game at UMass versus UNC for the semifinal of the college NCAA championships.
Mm-hmm. So North Carolina versus University of Massachusetts.
Exactly. Okay. And the head coach of UNC, Anson Dorrance, had two caps. He was the head coach of UNC, but also the head coach of the women's national team at the time. And so we were going to play a game in front of him, so he was going to be able to see me play in real life. Mm-hmm. And so I was really excited and fired up. And essentially, it was an absolute disaster. We lost 4-1, but the good news is that result wasn't a big factor for him, because what he saw in that game was very different than the scoreboard read, which was my resilience in that game, my leadership in that game, even though I was a sinking ship, essentially, with mm-hmm. regards to the score, my attitude and my ability to try to continue to rise up, rise up, rise up. And second half, it was 3-0 at halftime. We came into the second half and we essentially tied that half 1-1. And he saw me have such leadership, even in the face of defeat, that was really appealing to him. And he said recently in an interview that the thing I loved about Bri was her potential and her fighting spirit. Mm. And that's what he saw in that game.
So he was seeing you remain calm, mm-hmm. seeing you talk to your teammates mm-hmm. and being just focused on the game.
Yes.
Still time on the clock.
Exactly. Fighting for every ball, trying to make as many saves as I could, even though in the face of 4-1, I probably made, mm-hmm. I don't know how many saves, double-digit saves easily that game. And he appreciated my attitude in the face of so much mm-hmm. Adversity, and essentially said, you know, this is one of the greatest shot stoppers I've ever seen.
Oh.
Yeah. And 2 weeks later, I was in camp.
All right. So let's talk about the 1996 Olympics. Many people here in Minnesota would have been watching and cheering Team USA, cheering you on.
Yes.
You won gold in Atlanta that year. And I didn't remember this part, but I just recently read this, that was the first time that women's soccer was ever played in the Olympics.
Yes.
So I'm thinking about you getting on that plane. That must have been exciting, but also a little bit scary going there to compete.
It was so exciting. I had wanted to be an Olympian since I was 8 years old, when I watched the Lake Placid 1980 hockey team play against the USSR with my mom and dad on either side on the couch. If you remember, those of you in the mm-hmm. in the crowd there, remember that amazing feat mm-hmm. that they did, beating them after losing to them 10-3 just a couple of weeks before, and Jim mm-hmm. Craig literally spinning on his head, winning 4-3, and I saw that greatness and was so inspired that I jumped up off the couch and said, I want to be an Olympian. And then later, a few years later, when I was a teenager, I made a sign that said, Olympics 1996, I have a dream.
Really?
Yes. And then I found myself exactly in the place where I wanted to be in 1996.
Manifest it.
Exactly.
As the young folks were saying that, oh, she was manifesting.
I was manifesting.
So how old were you? You said you were 8?
I was 8 years old when I saw the hockey game on TV for the Olympics. Yeah. And I was, you know, early teens when I made mm-hmm. that sign, figuring that 1996, I'd be in my early 20s and I would be old enough to be able to be an Olympian at that point. And sure enough, I found myself starting goalkeeper on a defending World Cup title team that was going into the first women's soccer Olympics, full medal. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they're exhibition the first time in. And there I was.
Right. And then we've already talked about this. Your second Olympic gold medal came in 2004 in Greece. Mm-hmm. But that had a very different feel because yeah. of your father being ill and then him passing. And so those Olympic gold medals, when people envision those being hung across, you know, your neck. Mm-hmm. Can you still feel those moments at the ceremony when you were receiving them and waving, I'm imagining, and there's, you know, a huge crowd and there's cheers. Can you still kind of access that in your memory?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had to go there in order to describe it in the book with the amount of weight that it's required and that it justified having people understand how powerful a moment that was. So if you were to take your greatest dream magnified by 1,000, that's what it felt like to have that medal put around your neck, because the first thing you notice is the weight of the medals. They're
heavy.
So heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're just excited and you're there. You're in that moment that you've visualized for years as an Olympic athlete, after you climb up that mountain to get there, and what you feel is absolute elation, but what you also feel is an incredible amount of relief because you finally made it to the place you've been wanting to go for so long, and you did it with your teammates. And it's just an amazing feeling being on that podium with your teammates and just knowing you did the thing that you wanted to do most in your life.
And it just kind of all washes over you.
It does, yeah. Yes.
Right. That's beautiful. So few athletes get to play at the level that you did. What do you think made the difference for you? You said resilience mm-hmm. a few times. I love that word. Love that word. And on an emotional level, a mental level, I mean, and then just the training and the practicing. I mean, it just takes commitment. How do you describe? Mm. Like, why do you think you rose to such heights?
Well, I was blessed with fantastic athletic ability, mm-hmm. but I had that dream so young, and essentially that dream for me pulled me towards it and pulled it towards me. So we were running together because of the manifestation and the way I did that sign. I didn't realize that at the time that's how so many people achieve their goals, by writing them down. And therefore, your mind and your feelings are thinking about it all the time. And you're in that space. You're visualizing yourself being there. So that was a huge factor. And then, obviously, I needed a lot of things to fall in the exact right way for me. And success isn't a straight line, but my story proves that you don't have to necessarily get there in the most traditional way that you might perceive you would get to somewhere where you're going. A lot of different ways to get to the same place. And so for me, not coming up through the youth system, which is the way most of my teammates came up through, I had a lot of great coaches in my corner. And Jim Rudy at UMass was particularly vital. He was really good friends with Anson, and I didn't know that, but he knew where I could go. And so his belief in me, so support is a big a big help in achieving your dreams. Obviously, you have to ask people for help and have people help you. But in addition to that, just my work rate and my determination, my resilience, sometimes you don't win every game. Sometimes you lose. You have to keep going and just keep climbing towards that goal that you have. And you have it. It lives in your heart until you're able to manifest it in your life. And that is really what it takes to get to the top of the mountain, whatever that mountain is for you.
I've always talked to my kids a lot about be careful who your friends are. Because mm-hmm. I think that plays a critical role, too. Like the voices that you allow, yourself to be around. Like right. who's in your circle? Mm-hmm. Like are these folks who are going to encourage you or and also be straight with you when you need to be put in line?
Yes, exactly.
And I think those quality friendships matter. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much even like staying away from people who are negative or, right. Throw water on your dreams, mm-hmm. but character. Like mm-hmm. you want to be around people who kind of have the same values as you.
Absolutely. That's vitally important. But also focus on what you can control.
Mm. Say that again, please. Just talk to me. I need to hear that.
Focus on what you can control. Because if you're so worried about what everybody else is saying and doing and trying to put that on you, your worth is determined by how you feel, what you do, what you think about yourself, not put on you by other people. Because you're often going to have naysayers that think, you can't do this or you can't have that. You're going to have people who tell you that this won't work. Well, trust me when I say extraordinary people are born out of extraordinary desire, extraordinary goals that are bigger than them that seem literally impossible at the time when you first have the feeling or the thought to do it. The goal is usually way down the line in so many instances, but you have to control what you can control, your attitude, your work rate, your resistance to people coming towards you and at you and trying to tell you it's a silly idea that you can't do it. You have to have that instinctive and individual desire inside you be as strong as it possibly can be, because you're going to have those people and those things that deviate you off your track, but get right back on that track every morning. Reaffirm who you are, what you want, and what you want to do.
Brianna, I want to talk more about the injury that eventually ended your soccer career in 2010.
Yes.
Is that the right year?
Correct.
You were in the middle of a game, made contact with another player, and it was a knee to the head, mm-hmm. a knee to the head, to your temple, yes. I believe, that caused severe trauma, a serious concussion. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what happened there and just mm-hmm. like what that meant in the moment, the symptoms you had and, mm-hmm. and what was going on with your body.
Well, at that point in my career, I was 38 years old and I'd played, mm-hmm. so many years in the game and had a few concussions. Quite a few, actually, and only a couple were documented. Normally, those hits were a couple days here, a training session there that I would be out of the game and then back in. This particular hit was so devastating, in part because I never saw her coming. So she came from the right-hand side as I'm making a save to my left and came in and tried to nip around with her toe and get the ball before it got to me and essentially crashed into the side of my head with her knee. You can actually see a video of it if you go and look it up. It's there, and it doesn't seem like that big of a hit. And the referee didn't even call a foul. He's, the ref's like, come on, keep, let's go. And immediately, I knew things were wrong. I knew I was in trouble because I could see the names on the jerseys in front of me, were starting to get fadey and they were out of focus. I started like tilting to my left a little bit. My balance was really off. My head hurt, obviously, from where she hit me. And I started to feel sensitivity to just the sounds of the game and the lights and whatnot. And so I battled through the next several minutes of the game to get to the halftime. And then I was coming off the field to meet my trainer who was coming towards me. And I'm tilting to the left as I'm walking towards her, going to the left. And she came out to me and took my hands and looked me in the eye and said, Bri, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not. I knew there was something really wrong at that moment. We went into the locker room at halftime. Obviously, I was taken out of the game. That was the last game I ever played in a game that treated me so incredibly well for so long. Part of my greatest passion ended, you know, right then, April 25th, 2010. I had all these symptoms, the normal basket of symptoms that you hear, headaches, insomnia, difficulty, you know, balancing, difficulty with sensitivities, light, sound, and movement, inability to recall information, the cognitive issues, but also the piece that a lot of people don't understand at the time anyway, was the emotional part. For me, depression started to set in, anxiety, inability to focus, and the inability to focus piece was so mind-boggling. I could focus on a soccer ball in a World Cup final in a penalty kick shootout with 90,000 people holding their breath 107 degrees on the pitch. I could focus then, but I could barely remember what I was doing or reading or anything like that. I was struggling with simple math, you know, problems. It was a real difficult time for me. And normally I would recover. I was expecting that. But it wasn't happening.
This went on for years.
3 years. 3 years. And as time went on, I kept trying to get a job. I got a job as a general manager of my previous team when it was relocated to Florida. I struggled doing that. I came home every day and cried because my headaches were so, so devastating, always emanating from behind my left ear up, exactly the same every day. I was very curious and didn't understand why that was happening. The emotional piece was happening as well. I didn't realize that that was because of the concussion. I learned that later, but I was misdiagnosed so many times because the doctor said, well, you should be fine by now. Or they said, or you look fine. And I said to them, I know who I am. I know I'm not okay. I feel disconnected from everything I used to love. My friends and family know I'm a very different person. It's scaring them and it's scaring me. Somebody please help me. And I kept getting put to the wrong doctors, misdiagnosed. And that was part of the odyssey of my journey because I was misdiagnosed so many times. I couldn't find the right care. And when I did finally find the right doctor, thank goodness, Dr. Crutchfield, I had to fight the insurance company to allow me to see him because I didn't have insurance anymore. It was a workers' comp situation. And so I really struggled with that. And so it elongated everything. So I was sliding deeper and deeper and deeper into this depression and just trying to find any bit of light, any hope. And it was so hard. I struggled so much just to get through every day. And then when I had that slide into the depression area when I was suicidal, that was clearly the depths of my despair. And the memory about being with my mom and the thought of her having to deal with it was so powerful and scary for me. That kept me off that ledge. But then I was still in the space, though. I was still in that hole. And it wasn't until later when I was thrown a lifeline, when my friend, who was previously my partner, Naomi, and her partner, Fran, created a company called Tomboy Exchange. They had a Kickstarter campaign, and Chris Azizos, who is now my wife, at the time, this was 9 years ago, she saw that Kickstarter campaign, and she invested in the company. They got together and had dinner, and Naomi, who knew the plight of my situation, the insurance company not doing the right thing, bless her, for thinking, let me ask Krissa if she can help Bri, because Krissa owns a PR firm. Maybe she can put a little pressure on this insurance company to do the right thing.
Because you're a star. You're still a soccer legend. Like, exactly. How can this be happening to this famous woman?
Exactly. It was so wrong on so many levels with the insurance company. And I was sliding deeper and deeper because they were just dragging their feet about everything. She talks to Krissa. Krissa says, sure, I'll meet her. So Naomi calls me back and says, you need to talk to Krissa. And I said, okay, I'll do it. 3 days go by, I don't do it because I'm just so ashamed. I'm so I felt like a burden to everyone.
Write about being on the couch. You laid on the couch a lot.
Mm-hmm. I laid on the couch. I was self-medicating with Vicodin and alcohol, all the wrong things. But I needed something to take my mind off where I was and to feel a little bit better about my situation and my state at the time. And then Naomi calls me and says, "Did you talk to Krissa yet?" And I said, "No." She said, "Bri, if you don't call her, I will never speak to you again." And she meant it. And I knew it. And immediately when we got off the phone, I called Krissa right away. And that was the beginning of the rise out of that hole. She got a hold of my lawyers, insurance company, threatened them essentially with media coverage. How come this Olympian can't get the help? How come you aren't helping her? She's a hero. And they caved.
Come on, Krissa.
They caved, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Everybody wants to meet Krissa after they read that book because she's amazing. And then from that moment on, I got the procedure done. It was successful. I had two nerves dug out of my neck. That was amazing. The first step, a year of therapy, and I was out and I was on my way again.
And so a lot of questions here. So now with this, you know, meteoric rise, this horrible fall, and now rising again.
Yeah.
What do we call you? I see you as an advocate for mental health. I see you as someone who can educate us about, you know, sports injuries and concussions. Mm-hmm. I see you as someone who can talk about, you know, being an African-American athlete in a sport that, you know, has been predominantly white. Mm-hmm. You're an openly gay athlete. How do you see yourself now? And what is your mission right now in terms of helping people get something out of your journey?
Mm-hmm. I consider myself to be someone who is representative of so many different people. I am so many things in one person. I consider myself a trailblazer. I consider myself a warrior. I consider myself a TBI survivor. I'm an advocate. I'm a role model. I'm a strong woman. I'm entrepreneurial. I'm an inspiration. I am a creator. I am so many things wrapped up into one person. And I just want people to know that they are also very similar to me. In their own journeys, they can become so many different things wrapped up into one person. And what I would say about who I am a blessed person. That's who I am. I'm so grateful that I was able to come out of that. I'm so grateful that Naomi talked to Krissa. I'm so grateful that Krissa is so outstanding and amazing and that I fell in love with her and now we've been married for 4 years. I'm grateful I have two stepchildren that are amazing. I'm grateful they call me bonus mom. I have so many amazing things in my life. My life is so much better than I thought it ever could be. And what I learned was I took the event that was so devastating and I flipped it on its head. And now I'm grateful for that player that hit me in the side of my head. I'm grateful now for that concussion because if I don't have the concussion, then I don't have Krissa. Mm-hmm. And then I don't have the amazing life that I have now.
You don't have the story, and then we don't have this book. I want to thank you so much. I've enjoyed spending this hour with you. We've been talking with Brianna Scurry, the trailblazing U.S. women's soccer goalie, a world champion, Olympic gold medalist, a Minnesota native. Her new book about her life is called My Greatest Save. Thank you for your time, Brianna, and again, glad that you're back home in Minnesota for a little bit.
Thank you. It's so great to be here and so wonderful to meet you. Thanks for having me.
This conversation was produced by Lindsay Ginsel. Thanks for joining us today. Be safe, everyone.